Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and go to Tucson, Arizona for an update on the shooting of the U.S. congressman and the search for a motive and a second suspect. We'll be joined by David A.B. Morales, who writes for the Tucson Citizen and has been covering the tragedy that so far has claimed the life of six people, including a nine-year-old girl and a federal judge. We will also be joined by a local writer and social critic, Gregory McNamee, who will describe the toxic political environment in Arizona that the Pima County Sheriff referred to as not being directly responsible, but a contributing factor to the outrage in Tucson. Then we will go to southern Sudan for the latest on a referendum that will likely lead to the formation of a new country, as the largest country in Africa, Sudan, appears poised to split along North-South and Muslim-Christian lines. Susan Purdon, the country director for the International Rescue Committee, joins us from Juba. Then finally, we'll speak about the growing divide in the country between the financial elite and the middle class, and the divide between Wall Street and the predatory capitalists on Wall Street and entrepreneurial capitalists in the Silicon Valley. We'll be joined by the finance blogger for Reuters, Felix Salmon, who last week published an article on Reuters.com, How to Deal with the Plutocrats. I'm speaking with David A.B. Morales, who writes for the Tucson Citizen, and he's a native of Arizona, and he covers local politics for Tucson's progressive blog, The Three Sonorans. He joins us from Tucson. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Morales.
Hello. How's it going?
Well, now tell me, David, about so far, has there been any more information on the motives of this fellow that they have in custody who was tackled at the scene after he let fly a fusillade of bullets, I believe, wounding a total of 19 people, killing six, and among them, of course, the U.S. congresswoman who was shot in the head and whose condition remains critical?
At the current moment, there's no new information other than he was clearly a disturbed individual who had some very bizarre YouTube videos that he made and postings on, I think, MySpace that said that he was about to do, fans to be mad at him for what he was about to do. And on one of the videos, he mentions the rate of literacy and how low it is in District 8, which is Gabby Gifford's district. And living in Tucson, there's a lot of Gabby Gifford's district is along the border, and that's also where the rancher Robert Krantz was killed. And they accused a Mexican immigrant of doing the murder. No suspect. They have no suspect to this day. So there's a lot of anti-immigrant. That's also where the Minutemen were stationed. Neo-Nazis like J.T. Reddy and Sean Pierce, who's the son of Russell Pierce, the current Senate President of Arizona. It's a district of it's the Old West mentality still lives there. That's where Tombstone is.
Mm-hmm.
And so clearly, I think I call it more of a collective consciousness of hate, that maybe it's not necessarily one particular organization, but they all kind of work with the same mentality of, stop this invasion. I mean, the language that even our politicians use is this invasion. Taking over, that type of language instills a lot of fear in people, and then they do what what happened yesterday in order to save the country from possibly worse something that could.
Well, there's no direct evidence of a linkage between the killer and the Tea Party and these other issues that you're talking about, except that in his sort of incoherent ramblings about a new currency, he does talk a lot about literacy and grammar. And your feeling is that that's a code for the divide because of AB 1070 in Arizona between Hispanics and whites. And that's what he's really referring to, because I know that the right wing stations down there in Tucson are already calling him a communist. This shooter.
Yeah, I mean, right wing radio is crazy in Tucson, and You got to remember that, first of all, there's not really an official Tea Party. It's not a party, and there's not really one person that speaks for it. There's different splinter groups. So, it's hard to, if you wanted to make a direct connection to the Tea Party, that would be hard to do, because what is the Tea Party? But overall, there's this message of hate that they are definitely a part of, a message of fear the Mexicans. Blame them for all the problems, and blame them for taking your jobs, blame them for filling up the prisons, blame them for, every problem conceivable. And so their message is one of hate, and their message is one, so Jesse Kelly took on Gabby Giffords.
Jesse Kelly ran against Gabby Giffords. He was the Tea Party candidate who narrowly lost, to refused to concede, like the fellow up in Alaska. By the way, back in June, during the campaign, Jesse Kelly, the Tea Party candidate, advertised fundraisers saying, be on target and remove Gabby Giffords. Join me in shooting an M16. That was his way of paying people back for being donors to his campaign.
Yeah, and of course, there's Sarah Palin with the crosshairs on the district, and I'm also on Raul Grijalva's district, who's also in Tucson. So this is,
and he was shot. He was shot at, wasn't he? His offices were shot at.
It was actually Gabby Giffords' offices that were shot at, and Raul Grijalva has had multiple death threats, and he had a. They get like a suspicious white powders in the mail, and ordering evacuations and stuff. But what's also more disturbing about yesterday is that one thing that hasn't been talked a lot about lately is that the killer actually called each person's name before he killed them. So he knew who the staff was. He knew who's going to be there. He knew, he's been following Gabby and her and the crew. This is like a planned out execution style, and
now did he call out the name of the federal judge? I thought the judge was there by happenstance.
Right. He might not have called. I know that he called. This is all hearsay, but some people who were there said that he knew a lot of the staff, and he was calling them out by name. And of course, 19 were shot altogether, so not everyone. A lot of people were shot that are still alive. And fortunately, actually, right now, they just had a press conference at UMC, the hospital, and they said that Gabby Giffords is, she's alive, but the main fear is brain swelling right now, but she's able to respond to, like squeeze your hand type comments.
David A.B. Morales, tell me about this the second shooter that they're looking for. He's apparently a white male between 40 and 50 who was, in some reports, seen driving the shooter to the location.
Yeah, they don't know who he is. There's a picture of him online, and he, is an older man. And the news release says he's described as a Caucasian, 40 to 50 years old, dark hair, wearing blue jeans and dark blue jacket. There's a picture of him, though. You can clearly see his face. You can see him more or less. So he might have been the driver. There's not a lot known about him, but I can assure listeners of your show that there are a lot of people who maybe not were associated with yesterday's events are very supportive and will probably be associated with these events in the future, because there's a lot of militia groups growing in southern Arizona, and they're actually being encouraged by, for example, Pinal Sheriff County, probably a view who allows neo-Nazis to go out in the desert and hunt Mexicans basically for sport. In the name of national security. So, this type of event, we have more and more lax gun laws in Arizona, and, you can carry guns into schools and churches and bars. At the rallies last summer, J.T. Reddy, the known neo-Nazi, came loaded with, a shotgun and knives and guns and with all his crew, and he was shouting obscenities, racial slurs at the crowd. And, of course, the police are there to protect his Second Amendment and First Amendment. But, this is a public safety issue. This is you know, Arizona is ready to just explode with racial violence. And it's these types of games that people play with the First and Second Amendment. I mean, I take them very seriously. But, you know, if there was a bunch of armed Mexicans marching to the Capitol, you know, they would be arrested immediately as you know, instigators of a riot or something. But when the Tea Party does it, they're patriots and proud.
Well, I believe that Jesse Kelly, who was narrowly defeated by Congresswoman Giffords, is already starting his campaign for the next yes. congressional cycle. Mm-hmm. Let me bring in, if I can, a journalist, author, Gregory McNamee, who's also a research associate at the Southwest Center for the University of Arizona and a lecturer in the economics department in Tucson. And just in terms of a kind of social critic, Gregory, the atmospherics that David is talking about clearly prompted the Pima County Sheriff in his press conference to really go out of his way to describe a very toxic political atmosphere. He blamed talk radio and some television and basically said that people are, you know, castigated people who make a living out of stirring up divisions. And it's gotten so bad that the state of Arizona has become a mecca for bigotry and hatred. What's your description of the political environment down there in Tucson?
Well, I think that the sheriff was right by saying that Arizona had become a mecca of prejudice and bigotry. A little less toxic within the confines of Tucson, only because Tucson is an island in this kind of sea of red. It's a little bit bluer. Gabby Giffords is a centrist in what effectively is a very centrist district, and that's one of the ironies. Is, of course, she was accused of being a socialist and a communist and every other thing, when she is really quite quite conservative from a Democratic standpoint. So, but all that said, David pointed exactly correctly to this kind of racial toxicity that's kind of free floating out here in the desert. You know, the political discourse is terrible in this country to begin with, but in Arizona we had the confluence of all the health care discussions that began about in the spring of 2009, really, combined then with last spring's SB 1070 and this anti-Hispanic legislation that came down, and then the third stream in this kind of toxic swamp, which is the gun laws that again David referred to. Allowing things like conceal and carry without any background checks, which just seems to me a recipe for disaster. So the atmosphere is very strange around here. I think it's just a perfect storm. I can't imagine anybody planned it, but certainly it has come down to just an awful recipe for disaster.
So, Gregory McNamee, when Gabriel Giffords' father was asked by a reporter, "Did your daughter have any enemies?" He said, "Yeah, the whole Tea Party." What did he mean by that, do you think?
Well, again, back in the health care controversy, this was when the first really ugly signs began to emerge, and when Gabby Giffords, who constantly is traveling her district and holding public meetings and one-on-ones and constantly on the move, she was at her own town hall meetings throughout her district, was shouted down by these Tea Party types, screamed at, you know, in the same spirit as the fellow who called President Obama a liar from the floor of the Congress. These are people who were, you know, intimidating anyone who dared voice any kind of support for the Congresswoman or for, you know, what they're calling Obamacare, what our governor refers to with disgust and hatred as Obamacare. So that was really the first sign of it, and it came from that self-styled Tea Party. We can't make any direct links, but I find it very interesting that the shooter, the alleged shooter, had on his web page, apparently, some of the language calling himself a patriot, for example, which is a real keyword in this Tea Party movement. So the right-wing radio that are calling, there's people who are calling him communist, I think, are likely to be off the mark there. In all events, there was an image of a pistol lying atop a U.S. history textbook. And that's pretty suggestive to me of the same sort of imagery and the same sort of the positioning that these Tea Party types have pushed. Now, again, there's no direct connection, you know, no directive coming from Tea Party Central saying go and do this. But as David said, with the directive from Sarah Palin, you know, aim high, reload, you know, keep on firing. That kind of language matched with Jesse Kelly's, you know, take aim at this congressional seat and various other. It doesn't take much imagination to make a direct connection with intent.
Well, let me ask David A.B. Morales then, just in closing here, what do you think is going on? You're suggesting that the second person, even though they haven't found him, that there's a confluence of from the Tea Party, from the races, not just Jesse Kelly's race against a congresswoman who was shot, but also the neighboring congressman, Ralph Graviva. He was also there was a Tea Party activist who ran. Both races were close. A lot of you're saying that within this Tea Party movement down there, there's a lot of neo-Nazis and Minutemen. I mean, what kind of percentage? I take it you're saying that they're also enabled by some of the local sheriffs, including, of course, the famous Joe Apaccio, the fellow from Maricopa County, who encourages arming of citizens and posses.
In Tucson on July 29th, when we had our SB 1070 actions, that was the day it became law, there was a group of counter-protest, well, people protesting in favor of the law, and there was a lot of them wearing Jesse Kelly T-shirts. And they had no problem, you know, associating with Tea Party or the, you know, more extreme right-wing groups. Actually, one of them had to get arrested for trying to incite violence within our group. And this is spreading. Like, so someone just issued a release on the top 10 toughest sheriffs in America, and five of them are in Arizona. So you have Sheriff Arpaio in Maricopa with his tent city and, you know, making people wear pink underwear and eat green bologna and stuff, forming a posse to go hunting, you know, Mexicans out in the desert. And also you have, just south of there is Pinal County, you have Paul DeVue, who went on a white supremacist radio show. And he's the one who's allowing JT Reddy, who's a known neo-Nazi, to go out there hunting Mexicans out in the desert. You have just this mentality, this like old west, you know, even these words, posse, you know, like let's form a posse and get people together and go out, you know, and hunt us some Mexicans. And I mean, this it's going on white supremacist radio, associating with neo-Nazis, going to neo-Nazi rallies. I mean, this is stuff that would ruin your career in the past, and now it's almost like a you know, get you elected in Arizona nowadays, which is unfortunate.
Well, let me just have a closing word here from Gregory McNamee. Do you think that there, given this polarization in Arizona, do you think that this event in any way is likely to create, at least at the very least, some kind of reflection? You know, particularly given what the Pima County Sheriff was saying. I mean. Or do you think that that the lines are too rigid and far drawn?
Oh, I certainly hope that that the spirit of taking a moment and reflecting, which is really what Sheriff Dubnyk was saying. He said it's time for some soul searching, and I think that's exactly right. I think there have been a lot of people that have just been sitting on the sidelines and watching this, these extremists. You know, I spend a lot of time up in Maricopa County. Not everybody up there is a member of a neo-Nazi party, but there are a lot of people who have just been sort of standing by and watching as the neo-Nazis have had their way. With the complicity of the president of the Arizona Senate, as David said. I think that this event is going to stir a lot of people to reflect on that and to say what happened to, you know, talk about taking back your nation. What happened to the America of rational discourse and what happened to the America of reasonable dissent and things like that? So, regrettably, it often takes instances like this before people will stop and think, and but I'm hopeful that that's what will happen.
David, do you have any a sense that that this horrible tragedy could improve the situation in terms of a civil discourse?
I think if it was in isolation, perhaps, but the state legislators coming into session next week, they've already in the first week of the year. They've already banned ethnic studies in Tucson, and they've already mounted an attack on the 14th Amendment. There's another bill coming up, which is an attack on Plowler versus Doe, which requires schools to get the documentation status, the citizenship status of all their students. So, I mean, there's coming. I mean, schools are being cut. They still haven't balanced the budget, so people are going to be out of more and more jobs. People are getting sicker. But one thing that they never cut is prisons. In fact, they're building more prisons. So, you know, the plan is to just divert people from schools into the prison system, I'm thinking. But when you attack students, when you attack teachers, when you attack these types of people as they're doing with ethnic studies in Tucson, I mean, this is not good. This is not how a functioning civilization works. And with more and more bills coming, with more and more attacks coming, you know, Russell Pierce is a known, you know, I'll just say he's an extremist. And now they have a two-thirds majority in the Senate and the House so that they can introduce legislation, and even if the governor doesn't sign the bill, they can override any veto. So Russell Pierce really is really running the state right now. And he has a known extremist agenda. He's seen at neo-Nazi rallies. He's a high priest in the Mormon Church and actually ordained J.T. Reddy, and this was written about in the Phoenix New Times, into the Mormon Church. So, I mean, he's very close.
Well, who's J.T. Reddy?
J.T. Reddy is like the most popular neo-Nazi in Arizona.
I see.
One who's always showing up with guns at rallies, and he's pretty much a spokesperson for they're known as the NSM, the neo-socialist movement, I think, or Nazi socialist movement. But they're, you know, he's the one out there always spewing hate. He's the one who I was mentioning was out there hunting Mexicans in the Pinal County desert.
Well, I thank both of you gentlemen for joining us here today to give us a sense of the atmosphere that the Pima County Sheriff felt contributed to this tragedy, and I thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I was just speaking then with David Morales. David A.B. Morales is a native Arizonan who covers politics in Tucson for the Tucson Citizen and writes for Tucson's progressive blog, The Three Sonorans. And also joining us was Gregory McNamee, who writes and publishes about the politics and culture of Arizona and who is a research associate at the Southwest Center for the University of Arizona. And he's also a lecturer in the economics department there at the University of Arizona in Tucson. Let's take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the referendum in Sudan that's likely to create a new country in Africa's largest country along north-south lines and Christian-Muslim lines. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing, and I'm speaking with Susan Purdon, who is the country director for Southern Sudan for the International Rescue Committee. She joins us from Juba. Thank you for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Susan Purdon.
Hello, and thank you for calling.
And tell me, at this point, do you have any information you can share with us about the referendum and the extent to which it has led to a new country in Africa?
Well, the referendum voting started today. It's 10 o'clock at night in Sudan now. The voting started at 8 o'clock this morning, but it continues every day this week. So the outcome that we can tell you about is that it was a tremendous event. Huge crowds turned out. It was very orderly, very celebratory for people to have the opportunity to vote. And there were comments like, oh, the line is 5 hours long. And they said, we've waited years. We can wait 5 hours.
So am I correct in suggesting that it is likely to result in the formation of a new country, splitting Africa's largest country, Sudan, along north-south lines and Muslim-Christian lines?
It's definitely likely to be the decision of the voters to choose separation, and the division is between the north and the south of the country. While some folks characterize the struggle as Christian versus Muslim, there are actually Christians in the north and Muslims in the south. You know, I wake up in the south to the sound of this call to prayer from the minaret. So it's not strictly Christian and Muslim division. It's a southern-northern division.
So would this mean that there would therefore be a refugee problem with Christians in the north migrating to the south if the north proves inhospitable, and vice versa with Muslims migrating to the north?
There's been a lot of movement of people from the south, returning from them, having been in safety in the north during the conflict and coming back to the south to their homeland with the anticipation of the separation. Again, it's not about as much about Christian Muslim as it is about traditional ethnic groups that lived in the southern area versus the more Arab groups that lived in the north. Refugees are a term that we use for people who have crossed an international border, so these are considered returnees, having been displaced internal in Sudan during the time of the conflict.
Well, as you know, Susan Purdon, again, the country director for Southern Sudan, who's joining us for the International Rescue Committee, who's joining us from Juba, the leader of Sudan, President Omar al-Bashir, is also been indicted by the International Criminal Court as a war criminal. For the longest time, there has been civil war between the north and the south, leading to the State Department to describe the situation as a genocide. This agony has been going on for a number of years. I take it that the whole point of this is an attempt to end the agony, but it seems to be happening at the expense of Bashir, in the sense that he's losing half his country.
It's definitely a sense of loss for the government in the north to have the south separate. And just as there have been religious issues and ethnic issues, there are economic issues. There is oil reserves in the southern part of Sudan, and part of the difficulty between the two sides is sharing that wealth. The indictment of Bashir was concerning crime of genocide in Darfur, which is western Sudan, actually part of the area that will still be in the north. But yes, there have been conflicts in Sudan for decades.
So let's talk then, if we can, Susan Purdon, about the subtext of oil, which I think is a big factor here. And in splitting the country along north-south lines, and if the new deposits are in the south, that would make the South give the new Southern government a means to survive and prosper, perhaps. I take it, though, that the biggest player in these oil discoveries and the ones most likely to develop these new fields are the Chinese.
This is true. The oil has been known for some time, but the country of Sudan has been under economic sanctions imposed by Western governments. And so Western companies haven't had as much opportunity to explore or exploit the oil here. And the government of Khartoum has made a deal with the government of China. The reserves are in the area that's controlled by the southern part of the government of Southern Sudan, but the pipeline goes north to Port Said on the near the Suez Canal area of Sudan. So while the oil reserves are in the south, the actual opportunity to profit from them depends on that pipeline. So there really is a reason for both sides to cooperate in order to use the oil resource for economic use for the country.
Well, given that 80% of Sudan's oil reserves are in the south, and as you mentioned, Susan Purdon, the pipeline heads north, I understand, though, that the Chinese are exploring the possibility of building a pipeline from southern Sudan across Somalia through Puntland to Berbera, the port on either on the Arabian Sea or another port on the Indian Ocean for direct shipment to China.
Yes, I've heard that too. I've also heard that they were talking about a pipeline through Kenya to Mombasa. The challenge seems to be that it would take a number of years to build another pipeline, and the estimate is that the reserves will only continue to produce in sufficient quantities to be profitable for the next 15 years. So there's a trade-off if the decision is to incur a pipeline to the that's controlled by the south.
Again, I'm speaking with Susan Purdon, who is the country director for Southern Sudan for the International Rescue Committee, and she joins us from Juba. So give me a sense then of what is going on in the street and what is the kind of sense of, is there a sense of, you're saying there's a sense of celebration, but I imagine there's also some sense of foreboding amongst some people in terms of humanitarian issues that we were talking about earlier in terms of not so much refugees because they are displaced persons within their own country like we've witnessed in Iraq.
Very much. And in fact, there's an underlying humanitarian concern for the people of southern Sudan who have had very low levels of development because of decades of conflict ravaging the countryside. So we have a population that is very impoverished, very young. 72% of the population is under the age of 30, but also 70% survive on a dollar a day, which isn't a lot of money in anybody's calculation. So at that level of devastation caused by decades of war and the underlying poverty of a rural population, leads to poor health indicators, poor education indicators, and essentially a very low level of human development in general. So there's a lot of anticipation with this new independence that everybody expects will be the result of the referendum, leading to better things, more schools, more clinics, better health, better livelihoods for people. And the fact is the government is going to be very busy trying to learn how to be a new government and all the responsibilities that entails, border security, a new currency, what are they going to call the new country. And those basic services are going to take many years to develop. The international actors, like the International Rescue Committee, and the UN agencies are here to support the government and to help provide those basic services. So on top of the impoverished population that's been living here for forever, those folks who were displaced to the north are coming home. And since November, well, let me back up. The peace agreement was signed in January of 2005. And hundreds of thousands of people have returned over the 5 years since then. But since November of this year, in anticipation of the referendum, another 143,000 came back. And some of them haven't been able to go out into live into communities yet. And they're what we call stuck in transit centers. So they have no shelter, no basic services. And so right now, we're ramping up our health care in order to meet the needs of the folks stuck in transit.
But again, I'm speaking with Susan Purdon, who is the country director for Southern Sudan for the International Rescue Committee, and she joins us from Juba in Southern Sudan, and we're talking about the referendum that started today and that will continue for the rest of the week, that likely to split Africa's largest country in two along north-south and Christian-Muslim lines. And you were saying earlier that even though 80% of Sudan's oil is in the south, and this may prove to make this government viable economically, it is also dependent upon the pipeline that heads north through the country from which they're splitting. Given the history of civil war, do you think that Bashir is simply going to take this lying down? Is the die cast here?
That's a really hard question to answer. It's hard to predict the future. What we have seen in the language from the government of the North and the government of the South is a very calm language saying they will, both sides will respect the outcome of the vote, that they're very careful to say that Southerners in the North will still be safe, Northerners in the South will still be safe. One of the things that needs to be determined is citizenship. So will there be some sort of mechanism by which people are freely allowed to cross the border, or will there be a very defined and restricted access? But the political rhetoric is quite positive about accepting the results. I think that there has been a lot of influence and conversation across governments. When the peace agreement was signed in 2005, there were other countries that were sort of parties to that agreement, and they have been supporting it for the duration of the agreement leading up to the referendum and the referendum process. So there have been meetings in Addis Ababa to resolve some of the unresolved subjects. There are still unresolved things, but there is a lot of global politics going on to make it worthwhile for both sides to stay peaceful in the outcome of the referendum.
So just in closing, it would seem, Susan Purdon, that the Chinese are playing a key role. If they have been supporting Bashir's government against the wishes of the U.S. and the Europeans, at the same time, the oil is in the south, which the Chinese want to develop. So it looks like the Chinese are sitting in the catbird seat here.
Well, the Chinese do have a measure of influence, but there are others who still have a lot of influence, even in the West. President Obama has offered to reduce the sanctions against Sudan for a continued good relationship following the referendum, or a continued holding of the peace. Senator Kerry is here now for the referendum. There are special representatives from the U.S. government to both sides of Sudan. Jimmy Carter is here for the referendum. There's a lot of global attention being paid, and a lot of that is being directed at maintaining peace. The last thing anybody wants is for this vote to result in a resumption of conflict.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Susan Purdon from Southern Sudan. Thank you so much.
Thank you, too.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I've been speaking with Susan Purdon, who is the country director for Southern Sudan for the International Rescue Committee. She joined us from Juba in Southern Sudan. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Felix Salmon about how to deal with the plutocrats. Hello and welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and I'm speaking with Felix Salmon, who is the finance blogger for Reuters, This past week, he published an article on Reuters.com titled How to Deal with the Plutocrats. And Felix Salmon, in your article, you speak about the growing divide in the country between the financial elite and the middle class, and the divide between predatory capitalism on Wall Street and entrepreneurial capitalism in the Silicon Valley. But in the last week or so, we had the Facebook Goldman Sachs deal, and clearly Goldman Sachs is on Wall Street, and clearly they're going to be, whenever Facebook goes public, it'll probably be handled by Goldman Sachs. But what came out of that deal, at least the contours of the deal that we know so far, also describes a kind of new form of capitalism in the sense that companies want to stay private as much as possible, and they're skirting the FCC rules, the SEC rules, I should say, and the big players are getting in early and making all these deals as Goldman Sachs does through its wealthy partners who have to pony up, I think, $10 million before they can even enter the game. So do you see within the divisions that you talk about in your recent article another division, which is between private capital and the rest of the suckers who buy stocks on Wall Street?
Absolutely, yes. The one of the interesting things about the plutocrats, as we're calling them, you know, the international multi-gazillionaire elites, is that most of their money actually is private capital. If you are, you know, a Ukrainian steel magnate or, you know, a Brazilian beef magnate or something like that, the chances are that you made your money privately and that only maybe towards the very end of your career might you think about going public for reasons of, like, you don't know what to do with your, you know, how to divvy up the company between your family otherwise. So what we're seeing with Facebook and with Goldman Sachs is precisely this way in which wealth is increasingly being kept within that sort of plutocratic elite, and they don't feel any need to share it with the public, to list it on a public stock exchange. If they do list it on a public stock exchange, that's going to be, you know, against their best judgment, really. They feel forced into it by the SEC. And what Goldman Sachs and Facebook would much, much rather do is just keep the whole thing to themselves, keep it very private, keep it opaque. And, of course, if you're a broker-dealer like Goldman Sachs, opacity is how you make your money. Goldman Sachs doesn't really make any money from trading public stocks on the New York Stock Exchange. It makes a lot of money from trading, you know, illiquid private instruments like collateralized debt obligations or Facebook shares.
So, Felix Salmon, then I'm getting a picture here of this new capitalist elite and the plutocrats or oligarchs in this country. It would seem to me that the current system, which where hedge funds are very powerful and pay little to no, play less taxes, hedge fund managers pay less percentage of tax than their secretaries do, as we know, and these private equity groups, surely these hedge funds and private equity groups also have all the money from the plutocrats, don't they? Isn't that where the money's going and where the money's being shepherded and increased?
To a certain degree, yes. I mean, once you have a few hundred million dollars, you're likely to be parking a large chunk of it with hedge funds and private equity groups, especially the private equity people, actually. Those are the people who are really bad when it comes to paying income tax on their income and often just pay 15% capital gains tax instead. So this is yet another area where the money just kind of gravitates towards itself, and it circulates in a very small world of very rich people, and it doesn't trickle down. It doesn't become part of the broader economy so much. It's just rich people playing, you know, with money and transferring it among themselves.
So as the divide between the rich and the poor grows in this country, does that mean that this money is sort of growing in a sense of what I would describe as extractive capitalism, that wealth is being extracted and closeted, if you will, on the one hand, whereas the traditional role for Wall Street throughout the last couple of centuries, my understanding was that Wall Street's job was to create wealth and develop the entire economy. So I see a kind of Wall Street that's separate and apart from the rest of our struggling economy.
That's exactly right. What you see with growing inequality, of course, is basically wealth being moved from the mass of the economy, from like the rest of us, basically, to the elite. What we've seen over the past 15 years or so is that the share of income, you know, going to the top 1% of the population has gone up from 15% to 25%, something like that. And so that's a good 10% of the total national income, which used to go to the rest of us and doesn't anymore. So, you know, what we're seeing is money moving the wrong direction, essentially. We're seeing the flows going from those who can least afford it to those who least need it. And what we're not seeing is you know, the kind of gains to labor that we saw over most of the course of the history of the United States, you know, where productivity gains, if workers became more productive, then that would show up in increased wages. Nowadays, if workers become more productive, that shows up in increased returns to capital, that the owners of the companies do quite well and the workers don't.
Again, I'm speaking with finance writer Felix Salmon about his recent article on Reuters.com, How to Deal with the Plutocrats. So we've already seen some evidence of this. Here we have a president who may not even run again if the unemployment numbers are high. And we also saw in the recent election, which obviously the Republicans were successful, I think in part because of the Supreme Court ruling in Citizens United that allowed corporations unlimited money, which most of which went to the Republicans. But also there is this albatross over the president's neck, which is the economy. Ben Bernanke saying it's not going to really get better for 4 or 5 years. So the paradox here is that as bad as it gets for working American, the American middle class, and for the president's political fortunes, quite often unemployment, the number of people out of work actually helps Wall Street. They profit when people lose their jobs. And now they're sitting, apparently, on a lot of cash. The corporate America is sitting on a couple of trillion, and the banks are sitting on $3 trillion as well. That's what we're told. I don't believe it, but that's what we're told.
There is a huge amount of cash on corporate balance sheets. That's true. And it's cash which is not being put to work employing people. So that, you know, there's a definite case sense in which everyone would win, even the banks. I mean, it's not true that the banks benefit from unemployment. What happens when unemployment goes up is that default rates go up as well, and that actually hurts the banks. So what they do is they get cautious and they don't lend out, and companies get cautious as well and they don't hire, and so the economy just keeps on being sluggish and unemployment remains high. I mean, politically speaking, one of the big problems is that the long-term unemployed tend not to vote, and so it's actually less of a political issue than it should be. If, you know, the population of the United States were demanding that politicians do something about unemployment, then we would probably be in a better place, but it doesn't seem that they are. It seems that their priorities are elsewhere right now. And so I think that you're absolutely right, that what we want to do is fiddle around with public policy, maybe with a tax code, in such a way that we encourage corporations to take all of that cash that they're sitting on and use it to employ people. And there are lots of really sensible ways you could do that. For instance, what you could do is you could exempt corporations from paying payroll taxes on new employees, like basically to the extent that their payrolls go up. Why we haven't done this, I have no idea.
And Felix Salmon, in your recent article on Reuters.com, How to Deal with the Plutocrats, you talked to a number of the super elite, and I was fascinated by their attitudes to the endangered middle class, given that so far it's the middle class taxpayers that have bailed them out, made them whole. They're bigger and stronger than ever, making profits and bonuses, and meanwhile Main Street is languishing. But they don't seem to feel any shame, or they're not even seem to be sorry about what happened. And I was astounded at their attitude towards the middle class. It's almost sort of like Marie Antoinette.
It is, and to be clear here, the person doing the heavy lifting on reporting this story and talking to rich people was not me, but rather my colleague Chrystia Freeland, who has the cover story in a new issue of The Atlantic, which I can definitely recommend.
Yeah, I was planning on calling her and see if I could interview her next week.
Absolutely, and it's a good story, and that's the one which I was riffing off in my post. And she spent a lot of time talking to these people, and one of her big points, and she's absolutely right about this, is that the international plutocracy is really that. It's very international. It's not based nearly as much as it used to be in the sort of nation state. The days when what was good for General Motors was good for America, the idea that, you know, you had these big American millionaires and, you know, Standard Oil or something like that, these are very sort of national fortunes. It's still true to some degree, but increasingly these people feel like they're citizens of the world. They have houses in many different countries. They live in tax havens. They hang out with each other in lots of different countries and resorts around the world. And what they see, and this is, you know, important, is that income inequality is actually decreasing between countries, even as it's increasing within countries. And so what they're saying is that, yes, the middle class in the United States, you know, people earning, say, $50,000 or $60,000 a year, you know, household income in the United States, those people are being hurt. Because that income, while it's, you know, middle class in the United States, is actually extremely high if you're looking on at a global level. And you can find, you know, very well-educated people in India or China or Brazil who are very happy to work for a fraction of that. And those people, you know, who might be earning $15,000 or $20,000 a year, are having a much improved life. And there are more of those people than there are of middle-class Americans. And so the view is that if we're making the world richer and more successful by increasing the size of the middle class in places like Brazil or India, then maybe we don't need to worry so much about the plight of the middle class in the U.S. because we all have this very, you know, international perspective. Of course, you know, it's only the plutocrats who really have that perspective. The rest of us are much more nationally oriented.
So in effect, Felix Salmon, Adam Smith's prediction that capital would transcend nationalities is already happening.
And it has happened, yeah, it's been happening for a long time. There's a sort of cyclicality around it. Capital was very international in the 20s, and then that kind of came to an end with the Cold War and with Bretton Woods and various things like that. But definitely we are seeing a level of internationalization of capital flows and of rich people, which is almost unprecedented in the history of the world. You know, that you have CEO, you know, the CEO classes, you know, when Chrysler is being run by an Italian or Pepsi is being run or Citigroup is being run by an Indian, you know, this is quite unexceptional now. It's a very global class, and these people think globally, and while they care about the U.S. middle classes, often because the U.S. middle classes are responsible for a large chunk of their profits, You know, when it comes to hiring people, they look abroad because those people are cheaper.
Well, just in closing, Felix Salmon, let's go to your solutions. How do you deal with the plutocrats?
Well, one of my solutions is to reduce the size of the financial sector, which is far too big, and which also makes the economy as a whole far too fragile, because where the financial sector makes its money is essentially through leverage, by lending, you know, by levering things up and making them more dangerous. Like we saw during the financial crisis, if you have too much debt, you can cause a major catastrophe.
Well, they're also running up the price of gasoline at the moment, which hurts the middle class and helps Wall Street.
Yes, exactly. And so, you know, when you get asset bubbles, like we're seeing right now, asset bubbles, I mean, I don't know if you've seen the price of gold or of silver recently.
Yeah.
You know, all of these things are dangerous for the economy, because when a bubble bursts, especially if there's leverage there, you know, you can have major economic impacts. And so what I'd like to see is the banks regulated much more like utilities. I'd like to see a tax on financial transactions. I would actually like to see a tax on wealth. Like, various countries have started experimenting with this, and I think it's a really good idea. Rather than just having an income tax, that you should have a wealth tax. And if you have, you know, a liquid net worth of millions of dollars, you should pay maybe 1% of that per
year.
Well,
I'm afraid we've run out of time here today, Felix Salmon, but I thank you so much for joining us again. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I've been speaking with Felix Salmon, who's the finance blogger for Reuters. This past week, he published the article at Reuters.com titled How to Deal with the Plutocrats. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and engineer Devin Jordan. You may learn about the program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I'll be back tomorrow for another edition of Background Briefing. Until then, at 5 p.m., until then, bye for now.